We are very pleased to welcome a particularly interesting and gifted panel. And I am very personally pleased that that Don Molds, the Assistant Secretary in the Department of Health and Human Services, is responsible for planning and evaluation. And I would just stress in passing, we've talked about a lot of programs. One of the things that we consider best practice here at the National Academies, and which Don's group represents, is the importance of evaluation. Only too often we hear these great programs and very few metrics for how we would know if they were actually successful or not. But let me turn the panel over to you, Don, and let me thank you all for being here.
Great. I'd like to thank the NAS for holding this forum and bringing us together with our counterparts from Poland to discuss the subject of great importance, innovation in science and technology. In particular, I'd like to thank the Board on Science, Technology, and Economic Policy and the Director of the Technology, Innovation, and Entrepreneurship Program, Dr. Westner, who you just heard from. The National Academies of Science have been a source of, and is this working? Great. Of science have been a source of expert advice on matters of science, medicine, and engineering science to every president since Abraham Lincoln. Its leadership on council and Council on Innovation will be valued by President Obama, who has made innovation in science a priority. A quick look at President Obama's appointments to key positions tells you that the president values science. He appointed John Holdren, a nationally recognized expert on climate change and nuclear disarmament, as a nation's science advisor. He turned to a Nobel laureate to head the Department of Energy, and to a world-renowned scientist, Dr. Francis Collins, to lead the National Institutes of Health, which is part of the department I represent, the Department of Health and Human Services. Another indication of the administration's commitment to science is the strength of our investments in this area. My own department, HHS, supports a portfolio of health-related research that includes biomedical, behavioral, and health services research in such research areas as genomics, cancer, environmental health, child health and development, aging and comparative effectiveness of treatments. This panel will engage in a discussion about how advances in science are being translated into clinical research and practice. By far the largest supporter of research in HHS and the largest supporter of medical research in the federal government is the National Institutes of Health, whose budget is expected to reach $31 billion in fiscal year 2010. Most of this money will be awarded in the form of grants and contracts to research institutions in the U.S. However, in FY 2008, NIH awarded $350 million directly to institutions in countries other than the U.S. in recognition of the power of international collaboration in science. NIH is a key player in advancing medical research. However, in the U.S., the private sector also supports research and is responsible for development of technologies such as drugs and devices. Government-supported research has fueled a number of U.S. and international industries, including the biotechnology industry. One would expect that nanoscience will spur the development of a commercial sector based on this emerging science. You can see this happening already. Dr. Grudzinski, from the National Cancer Institute, is going to talk about the flow of innovation from academia to the commercial sector using nanotech as an example. Nanotechnology is cross-cutting in its applications. Many of our federal agencies outside of the health sector support research on nanotech. The EPA, the Department of Defense, and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, to name a few. The U.S. expects to invest about $1.6 billion in support of the National Nanotechnology Initiative, which reflects the administration's support for transformative research and development occurring across federal agencies. Another U.S. priority is improving education in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. In November, the President announced an initiative, Educate to Innovate, a nationwide effort that includes over $260 million in public-private investments to strengthen STEM education. Although most of our activities are geared towards advancing science and medicine in the U.S., we know that health is a global issue. Disease and disorders know no boundaries, and increasingly we are realizing that working towards solutions can also have no boundaries. Very pleased to be here with our distinguished colleagues from Poland and from the National Cancer Institute to facilitate a discussion on strategies to advance health research in our two countries. And with that, I will pass things over to, Dr. Drzezinski is going to start things off, and then we will move on, if that works. Oh, is that, do I have it wrong?
Okay. Thank you, Dan, for introduction and distinguished guests, dear colleagues. I would like to start with classical picture introduced by Canadian Minister of Health, Marc Lalonde, in 1974, showing that medical care is responsible for 10 to 20% of our health, nowadays up to 30. And to broaden this picture, I want to present the Tallinn Charter, new paradigm introduced by WHO last year that relates health system, health and wealth all together, enforcing performance impact of the economy on the economy and health outcomes and the most important parameters of the system. What about nations' health and performance of health system in the United States? Let's start with the most important parameters, health expenditure and the life expectancy. Let's start with Poland. You can see that almost life expectancy, about 74 years in the United States, 76, and in Canada, almost 80. And what about health expenditure? In Poland, 6% of GDP, in Canada, 10%, and in the United States, 15%. So the performance of the systems are quite different. What is the structure of the healthcare expenditure per capita by source of funding in the United States and the European countries? Only Netherlands are very similar to the United States structure. What about the number of adults that had serious problems with access, cost of, or administrative aspects of care in the States, and similar data come from Poland, almost 40% of people, of patients. And what about the number of patients dissatisfied with quality of healthcare in the US? The same figures and the same process is going in most European countries and in Poland. What about most important data about Polish and US expenditures in health? 24 billion of US dollars in Poland, and here you have figures in the United States, US dollars, and the percent of expenditures for health system in Poland and US. And also totally different structure of public funding, national fund, private insurance, and out-of-pocket expenditures in our countries. So we have totally different systems which can learn each other from each other much. And I believe that Polish experts can do much and do help really much in analysis of risks of undergoing health reform in the United States. The third part of my presentation deals with comparative effectiveness research, which gained a priority of the government in the US in 2009. Here you have, let's say, healthcare delivery systems, secondary and primary research area, and cardiovascular and cancer much farther. So, let's say, I have discussed with my colleagues in Poland from private and public universities, some areas that can be explored together. And number one is comparative effectiveness of strategies to enhance clinical and funding decisions by optimizing evidence base with non-standard methods versus standard meta-analytic tools. The second topic is analysis of, with IT-assisted systematic public finding decision-making versus unsystematic discussion-based decision-making. The third topic deals with e-health and telecare. We think that there is a strong need to improve healthcare supported by home use clinical status monitoring systems. And number four, very important, how to influence and how what strategies to introduce to influence society's level of satisfaction from public healthcare system. I don't have enough time to discuss all topics, but at present, this is clear that we have there is a lack of head-to-head trial data. There is a need for real-world data. We are missing this data. We have data only from meta-analysis and optimal conditions-driven projects. There is also standard meta-analytic tools deemed insufficient for aggregating data with varying quality. So at present, the decision makers faced with multidimensional frameworks for funding decisions. There is increasing public expectation for transparency and reasoning for funding decision. In terms of topic number three, the necessity of introducing homemade and home monitoring, for example, for heart failure patients. We have 1 million of heart failure patients in Poland and 6 million of heart failure patients in the United States, and they make a strong impact on hospitalizations and the costs. They may be really decreased by home monitoring, and we have just finished some large projects in Poland together with our German partners. And topic number four, the level of satisfaction is very hot. As I was discussing with Dan before the session, the major reform of healthcare system in the United States takes place, and high-level decision makers and politicians need to know the methods to address this issue in public debate to optimize chances for success. That is now going to be introduced in Senate. And the last part of my presentation is dealing with the impact model. The impact model was introduced by researchers from the Liverpool University, and it explains the decrease in deaths from coronary disease. Everybody in this room is interested in how to prolong his or her life. It is the very important topic for policymakers, and I would like to suggest a comparison of changes in Poland and U.S. for years 1990 and 2005. Let's go back now to the 1937 year at the University of Vilnius. You have a photo of six most distinguished researchers and professors at Vilnius University, and look carefully. Everybody is smoking. They knew how to prolong their life because in the 50s, almost all of them, they stopped smoking. This is a fantastic paper delivered by Sir Richard Pitto, made by 33,000 of observation of male doctors in UK born in the beginning of the last century. And the observational period was started in 51 and lasted 50 years. You see the large difference of probability of survival for doctors who were smoking and who were not smoking. Imagine that 83% of all doctors these times were smoking. Only 17 were producing this curve. Coming back to the history, the year 1947, Dr. Ansel Case in Minneapolis delivering a lecture on epidemiologic transformation and the increasing amount of deaths due to heart diseases. Very important period and very important study, Framingham Heart study, started in the United States. Of course, we could not follow this research in Poland. This is my university library after the Second World War. This is the rector of the university. So the whole research on cardiovascular diseases, epidemiology and prevention was mainly driven in the United States, and then European countries followed this. Let me say a little bit about the impact model. All important data on prevalence and control of risk factors, patient groups, treatments, and endpoints should be introduced, and the model was originated for England by Liverpool Group and published in Circulation 5 years ago. And this is very important because we now know what risk factors were important for reduction of deaths in England and Wales. For example, smoking was the most important factor, and legislation was number one. Obesity, diabetes, and physical activity, this is negative influence. And acute myocardial infarction treatment or secondary prevention, the influence of treatment, as I told from Lalonde times, changed from 20% to 30% of influence of on our health. What about life expectancy in Poland in years 50 to 2008? You see, we have a great success starting from early phase of transformation into market economy. What area is the most important in this? Cardiovascular diseases. Decrease in cardiovascular diseases was the most important factor contributed to this result. This is an excellent paper published in British Medical Journal by Professor Zatoński Group and his English colleagues about the decrease of number of deaths in Poland, which resulted in ecological study from large decrease of, for example, butter consumption 3 times and large increase 2 to 3 times of fruits and vegetables. So there was a hypothesis that dietary factors played a very important role. This is a research performed by my team in Poland starting from 1994. During transformation period, we also faced negative trends as far as awareness of blood pressure is concerned, and this is due to social factors that we face during a transformation period, and I have published it in Journal of Hypertension. Let's summarize the data from Poland that experienced totally different circumstances than the United States. The total cholesterol decrease was responsible for 30% of change. And this is the leading factor of reduction of death in Poland. And for example, hypertension, systolic blood pressure, that was a just opposite direction. So ecological studies and epidemiological studies were showing the same. And at the very end of my presentation, I would like to show Professor Kleiber and other American colleagues that we can also make some plans for future, and we can talk about strategies for future. What additional changes can be reached if we follow another country's experience, or if we follow the targets in the US for Healthy People Program or low-risk cohort. So, in conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, I strongly believe that comparative effectiveness research and impact model analysis can really help us to understand our systems, and I hope that we will be continuing this discussion. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Ann Barker. I'm the Deputy Director of the National Cancer Institute here in Washington, actually in Bethesda. And I want to thank the National Academy for organizing the meeting and to my Polish colleagues for being here. The National Cancer Institute is the largest of the institutes at the National Institutes of Health. We're about a $4.8 billion agency, and I think in a minute you'll see why that is true. I was struck, actually, by this first presentation, which actually set the stage so well for what I want to talk about. And I thought that we should go back, but I guess we won't, to that first slide, Dr. Jaworski's slide on what actually contributes to disease was quite fascinating. We spend an enormous amount of our funds in the U.S. and around the world now sort of sorting out the biological space genomically, but he pointed out to us that the genes you inherit are responsible for 10 to 20% of the disease that you will ultimately get, and another 5 to 10% is in the environment, and about 40 to 60% is lifestyle. Now, that's very intriguing when you think about the fact that those are all controllable, many controllable factors here. And if you look, I think, at the cardiovascular story, which is quite a great story for healthcare, so much of that was in change in human behavior. And my take-home message, I think, from what I have to say from the National Cancer Institute's perspective is cancer is a global problem. The one thing that wasn't pointed out in that slide is some of these diseases are so age-dependent. And cancer actually occurs, and it's most prevalent once you reach the age of 55 and older. And as you look around the world today, those populations that we are looking at are aging. Japan, for example, aging ahead of the curve, most of our curves. I just came from China. Dr. Gudensky and I were in China last week talking to the Chinese about many of their issues. We've been working with the Chinese for over 30 years in cancer research. And some of the seminal studies were done in China on what we know about environmental pollution and cancer. For example, the first presentation this morning, I was intrigued to see that we're still sorting out the issues with coal in China in terms of the amount of lung cancer, in tin miners, and in benzene exposure. These are all things that we're doing, and they're really contributing to the global enterprise, not just to what we're learning in the U.S. or regulating here or in Poland, but in terms of the global enterprise. So I guess my take-home message is cancer is global. The solutions will be global. And all of the issues that we face and share are global. And so this is a global problem, and I think it's a nice model for disease in general in terms of how we're going to have to look at this in the future, because so many of these diseases are going to be chronic diseases. They're not going to be the easy ones anymore, the infectious diseases. So cancer is really, in my opinion, a healthcare crisis in the United States. About 560 million people will die this year. We'll diagnose about 1.4 million new cases. It's not much different in Poland, actually. The only difference in Poland, I think, in the U.S. is some of the tumors in Poland that are still big problems, like gastric cancer, for example, we have actually conquered pretty well in this country, although it seems like we get one of these cancers under control and it starts to rise again for other kinds of reasons. And we are seeing some slight increases, for example, now in gastric cancer. And all gastric cancer is not caused by H. pylori. There's other kinds of gastric cancer. The issue for us, and I think was reflected in some of the costs you see up there, is cancer is an extremely expensive disease. And as I say, it's chronic, and the treatments are pretty horrific and produce all kinds of morbidity in patients, which adds additional cost. So the cost of cancer on an annual basis is somewhere around $219 billion now. And as we see these populations age, we anticipate an increase from 30 to 50% in the incidence. Now, that is devastating news, because if you look globally, this number is, by 2020, the number of deaths will rise to somewhere over 10 million people. And if you start thinking about the cost of that, not just in the cost of human life, which will be a significant factor, the cost of actually taking care of these people is amazing. And we spent a lot of time in China last week, 2 weeks ago, talking about this, because the Chinese have 350 million smokers in their population. Their incidence of lung cancer is going to go through the roof. And it's a very complex social issue as well as an economic issue there. And this is true in other countries, although, as you saw, the incidence of smoking is coming down, although, in my opinion, not nearly fast enough. So at the National Institutes of Health and at the National Cancer Institute, we have our eye on the future. We're really thinking about what's it going to take to move from this current very unsustainable model of healthcare to something in the 21st century that makes sense. So what we're trying to do is focus on understanding these diseases at a point where we can actually do something about them. And cancer is especially difficult in this regard, because every cancer is substantially different from the other one. And I'll talk about a little bit more about that. We need to diagnose these diseases much, much earlier. If we get them earlier, surgery can cure them, radiation can cure them. We have made very little progress against metastatic disease in the last 50 years. 50 years. And if you have metastatic cancer, you come in with stage 3 or stage 4 cancer, we cannot cure you. We can make your life better, and we can actually sustain that, but we will not cure you. We are not in this country, and I think globally, really connecting the research enterprise to the care enterprise very well. So what you hear from the academies and from other places is, let's be more innovative. Let's think about new models for moving science into the clinic. And I think that's critical. And I think this convergence is going to be absolutely necessary to really leverage what we're learning today in areas like genomics and proteomics and nanotechnology, as you'll hear in just a second. So we are working diligently and every single day at the National Cancer Institute and across all of the National Institutes of Health, not just in our laboratories here in the U.S., but globally. We have many, many partnerships globally, and I think the Polish relationship will be one of those that will develop over the next few years to develop this 21st century model, which is the model, I think, that will drive all of healthcare. And I would maintain that health is going to be the major economic driver in this century. I think knowledge-based economies are going to arise, and that's for sure. But those populations that are healthy and are able to take advantage of that will actually lead the world. I came to the National Cancer Institute in 2002 from a diverse background in academia, the nonprofit, and the private sectors. And I wanted to do some different things, and that's why I came there. And I've had a lot of interesting experiences, and I believe very much in public service now. I think most people should come and do this kind of thing, figure out what you can do within the government. And so we have undertaken, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to be involved in all of these initiatives, several initiatives to build this continuum for personalized cancer medicine. So we started with something simple. The samples for personalized medicine are going to come from humans. Well, that was a surprise to a lot of people. I know that shouldn't be a surprise, but we found out that our biorepositories, not just here but around the world, weren't very good, and I'll come back to that. We are not connected as an enterprise. Medicine is the last, I would say, and probably the most difficult enterprise to connect. We have research data, we have clinical data, we have data in all kinds of silos, not just here, but around the world, and we are not connected as an enterprise. So we started an initiative at the NCI, which I had the pleasure to launch, called the Cancer Informatics Grid, and it's actually been quite successful. We have over 800 groups working with us on this platform now, including all of our cancer centers. We have to marry these data sets. We have to marry what we know, and it's going to be not an easy task. Genomics, Francis Collins and I, before he went off to NIH, started something called the Cancer Genome Atlas. It's a very aggressive project. It's been very successful. I want to tell you just a little bit about that. Proteomics, as you know, the genome is only half the story. It gets translated into these wonderful machines that determine who you are and what you do and what you look like. They're actually nanomachines. We decided that it was time, actually, to understand this relationship between the genome and the proteome very difficult again, but we started something called the Clinical Proteomic Technology Initiative, which is really tied into the how we get this to the clinic. Systems are arising. Actually, cancer is an emergent complex system. That's what it is. The physicists in the audience will know what that means. Most biologists don't have a clue what that means. And so we have brought physics and computation to biology. And systems biology is the way the world will work in the future. And building on the nanotechnology initiative, which is actually the first initiative that I started at the NCI, I'll come back to that, we also now have entertained bringing the physical sciences into biology. And it's been very exciting. It's the last thing we've done in the last year. And to say, as my grandson would say, it's extremely cool, and it's going very well. But let me go back and talk just for a second about what I see happening in science is really kind. Elias Zerhouni, actually, our former director of the NIH, showed this slide once, and I was so enamored of the slide that I stole it just with no conscience whatsoever and revamped it around some of the things we've done at the NCI. And if you think about science, we start out with observation, and biology is very good at observing. But the computational people and the physicists will tell you we're not really very good at theories. We're not really very good at integration of data. We're not terribly good at actually at systems thinking. But as you look at the S-curve of science, biology is now moving up this S-curve, much as physics did years ago. And we're moving toward an integrated look at disease. And I think that's going to be the defining quality of biomedical sciences in this century. And as you see, we have tried to map our initiatives along this S-curve and think this through. All of these things have to be pursued in parallel now, and it's quite challenging. So starting with the Foundation for Personalized Medicine, what we found out at the NCI, we support people collecting samples all the time. They go out in the clinic, they collect samples. In doing the Cancer Genome Atlas, we found out that only about 30% of those samples were of sufficient quality to qualify for high-throughput science. Now, why is that important? Because there is a convergence now, a very large science, based on what we did and learned in the Human Genome Project, to enable what small science has to do in the future. So we needed to fix this. And so what we have done over, and I have to tell you, this problem is the toughest problem we've ever tried to solve within the government, in my opinion, at least in biology. Everybody wants to own their samples, and they think they're perfect until you ask them to go look at them. They think what they have is what they have, but they find out that they, A, they don't have what they thought they had, and two, it isn't very good. So we have set up guidelines for biorepositories in the country, and we're going to make this a condition. If you take our money, you're going to have to produce high-quality biospecimens. That's only fair because the patients are the individuals who give these samples, and they're the ones who will not be served if, in fact, these samples aren't very good. We haven't solved this problem completely, but we've made great progress on it. I mentioned the Cancer Bioinformatics Grid. It's actually a very successful open source, open access information platform. And it's designed to move what we know in research into translational research and what we can get into the clinic. And it's being very successful. And I think it's a perfect model, I think, to think about how we might move to do some of the comparative effectiveness that was actually cited a little earlier. I want to say a little bit about this project, because I think this is the defining project maybe of the 21st century, and many countries around the world are involved in this project. So after the completion of the Human Genome Project, so what's next? We knew the sequence of the normal human genome, but how does that help us in terms of medicine? How does it help us in terms of disease? Well, you have to go and you have to figure out how to sequence these tumors in this case. So Dr. Collins and I decided that we would just undertake this very, very, very aggressive program 3 years ago as a pilot, because it's big science and we weren't sure how to do it. And it was going to involve literally hundreds of people working together. And team science is just coming into biomedical research. By the way, the Cancer Genome Atlas, the acronym for that is TCGA, which took more time to come up with that acronym than it did to design the project. And you can see, if you know anything about biology, TCGA are the four bases of DNA. So that made it, you know, very attractive to Francis and myself and lots of other people. So this became the acronym for the Cancer Genome Atlas. So we finished the three-year pilot, and we took three tumors to look at, and we finished two. We took brain tumors, glioblastoma, which are always deadly and cost us enormous amounts in terms of human life and cost. We took on ovarian cancer, which is diagnosed very, very late in women and unfortunately still very lethal, and lung cancer. We're just getting into lung cancer. But I'll give you the take-home message. This has really been revolutionary. It has changed these two diseases already. Already, the work from glioblastoma has identified four subclasses of tumors. We're already beginning to really deliver therapy that way by actually classifying these diseases as they come into clinic. The ovarian cancer data will be published this, I guess, December or early January. I predict it will change that disease completely. So this is a game-changing approach. It is absolutely a revolutionary approach. I think that we have the president took note of it, and he gave us some money through the stimulus package, and he's requested, I should say, told us that we'd like to finish 20 tumors in the next 5 years. And we are working on this internationally with lots of countries as well, and I think we'll pull this off. But this is, I think, takes us to the point of actually filling in that biological space so that we can actually address a cancer, a disease like cancer, with evidence in the future. To show you how complex this is, there are many, many laboratories across the United States, all of the leading genomic centers participating in this. And these are the three tumors, and this is the complex of data, just a snapshot of all the data we're getting. This is real patient data. These samples all come from real people, and we know everything about them. Now, that presented us another problem, and I would argue a global problem for all of us, is you can now identify patients from these kinds of databases. So we had to establish new approaches to actually even looking at the data. But this is something that on a global basis we're going to have to come to grips with. And if you look at the number of groups involved, we had to organize this big science-wise, so there are lots of samples coming in. We have a centralized approach to processing them. We have seven cancer centers, genome centers that actually characterize them, three centers that sequence them, then we have a large data management system. So this is very big, very high throughput science, but it works. And I have to tell you, we should not worry about team science. If people become bigger and part of something that is so much bigger than themselves, they are so inspired to be part of this. And it's been an amazing journey, this whole project. And I may be talking a little too much about this, but I have to say, I think this is one that globally will be game-changing. And as you can see, it is a pipeline. And at the end of that pipeline is the biggest challenge we have, and that's integrating the data. And we, in the United States, have not trained nearly enough computational sciences. And as you heard earlier, this whole issue of algorithmic approaches to looking at data for disease is going to be the wave of the future. So this is an area where we have work to do, and we have collaborations to build so that we can actually analyze these very complex data sets. I'll tell you about one other project very quickly, a program that we've just put, 12 centers in place. We decided about 2 years ago we really wanted to bring physics into this whole process and think about genomes get translated in three-dimensional space and time. They are not in three, and they're not in two dimensions. They're actually emergent systems. So we held several meetings. We brought a lot of physicists together, and we decided to set up some new centers, and the centers are absolutely incredibly innovative. And some of the things that they're focused on are deconvoluting the complexity of this disease. How does information get transferred in cancer? How does it get transferred, period? We talk about signals. Well, physicists will tell you there's only so many ways that things can be signaled. Biologists don't think about any of them, I should tell you. Evolution and evolutionary theory. Cancer is an evolutionary disease, and we don't think much about that in cancer research. And then finally, everything that goes on in the whole cancer space is driven by forces, by gradients, by all the things that drive everything else in the universe. So we've just now got the computational and physicist scientists in to think with us about this disease across all of these length scales. Again, physicists know what length scales are, so I think this will be another game-changing, innovative approach to science. This is just an example that we need to think in terms of space and time about all the things that we think we know now about cancer biology and in biomedical research, and I think this will be another wave of the future that we're going to see. Piotr Grudenski is going to talk about nanotechnology. I saw this when I first came in. I'm a chemist before I was a biologist. I think this is going to be the absolute requirement to deliver the drugs of this century, to diagnose the diseases of this century, and to actually multiplex all these functions. Only nanotechnology will be able to do this. And so we have great centers. They have done great work. I can't say enough nice things about the people who are engaged in this. As Peter will tell you, they've been ragingly successful at commercializing their technologies. These centers have formed over 35 companies to send their technologies into the clinic. I'll stop there and say that I think as a global community, there's some things we need to do for cancer in this next decade. We need to know as much as we can about every cancer, and I think we're on a road to do that. And we need an affordable cancer genome. Everybody in this world is going to get their genome done eventually. I'm convinced of that. It has to be under $1,000. We need real diagnostic and predictive biomarkers for clinicians. They can't guess what you have, and they can't guess if your drugs are working. We need to connect this enterprise through new bioinformatics platforms that are searchable, and we can move toward in silico discovery, and I think we will increasingly use computation and clinical trials models that we don't even have yet to actually move this whole field forward. We will have increasingly prevention based on risk, and that's tough. But from some of the work I saw yesterday from some of our Chinese studies, I think it's going to be possible. And we need some of the biosensor work and other work to actually get us way in front of the curve in terms of these chronic diseases, especially advanced imaging and the chip technologies. And then we need lots of interventions for these diseases. One size is not going to fit all here, and that's the way we treat people now. It doesn't work for cancer, never has worked, and we're just in the process of changing that. And finally, we need electronic medical records, and those countries that have them make us envious. I think that I'll stop there and say that I think cancer is a great model. It's a great global model because it is going to be the global disease of this century. It is also the disease that pulls us together scientifically, and I think actually as we move forward, it will require enormous innovation to conquer the disease that is so complex that has defied us for this, more years than I want to remember. So welcome to our Polish colleagues, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor for me to represent the Ministry of Health of Poland again and also to represent my own university. You can see there is the youngest faculty of medicine. After many years spending in Warsaw, I was invited to build a new faculty of medicine in this city where is the castle where Nicolaus Copernicus had the flat and he wrote the main part of his revolutionary paper. So, coming to the description of our resources, there are 12 Polish medical schools in the middle of Europe, near the border of the European Union. There are 12 medical schools in the universities, mainly medical universities, and part of them, like our faculty in the all-type public university. There are also the Polish governmental research medical institutes. The three of them are dedicated mainly or partly to do cancer research. The largest one is the Cancer Institute with the three centers in Warsaw, in Silesia, in Gliwice, and in Krakow. And another one is a hematological institute and the Institute for Pulmonary Diseases. Cardiovascular Institute, the Cardiological Institute, is concentrated on the research on cardiology and vascular diseases, and there is also the historically established many years ago the Rheumatological Institute. There are three concentrated on the children research, the two of them in Warsaw and another one in Łódź, in the middle of the Poland. In this center, the research is conducted not only for the children problems, but also for the mothers. There's the Psychiatry and Neurology Institute, quite new ideology institute, and there are few public health, food, and drug institutes, and free for occupational medicine. There is also a very important part of research which is realized in the Division of Medical Sciences of Polish Academy of Sciences, and there are five institutes which belong to this. The main is the Medical Research Center, Polish Academy of Sciences, Warsaw, also there are centers in Łódź for medical biology, in Krakow for pharmacology, Poznań for genetic research, and Wrocław for immunology experimental therapy. There was signed 1 year ago legal paper signed by our Minister for Research and for Higher Education, Mrs. Professor Kudrycka, and there were decided five directions of priorities in health research: epidemiology and lifestyle diseases. And Professor Dojewski presented this part: molecular basis of the diseases, the implementation of molecular biology methods in the diagnosis, corresponding to that what the previous speaker, Mrs. Director from Cancer Institute presented. And nervous system function diagnosis and treatment of psychiatric neurological diseases, regenerative medicine, and new technologies in pharmacotherapy. I will present the examples of this, what is possible to be realized in, and it was done in Polish sector, because I'm personally involved in neurology, neurosurgery. It's normal that I begin from this. There's restorative neurosurgery, neurology. It's a branch which was realized since many years, but new directions occurred. There was electrical stimulation, still is realized and promising, stimulation of the spinal cord and the brain, delivery drugs into the cerebrospinal fluid and space in the brain. And the newest one, I think, the stem cells implantation, very, very promising and still developing. I'd like to show a few slides from my lecture I had 2 years ago in National Institute of Health in Bethesda. And what was interesting, that the beginning of the knowledge about the electrophysiology happened in big part in 19th century in the Poland and surrounding countries like Russia and Ukraine. The first man who registered electrical activity and didn't know that a few years ago his colleague Dr. Katon did the same. It was Professor Adolf Beck, who was also the rector of our Jan Kazimierz University in Lwów, former part of Poland. He was a neurophysiologist of Jewish origin and discovered electroencephalography, published it in 1890. Galvanometric record of brain cortex activity was published in another Polish journal together with another professor, Cybulski, in 1896. And there are such records published in 1914 with the evoked seizures, epileptic seizures. We follow this tradition, and now we are testing new and any possible methods of surgical treatment of epilepsy. Here you can see the activity of the brain with discharges, and after the operation, improvement of the recordings. But there are also many new studies conducted here in the United States just before the introduction to the market, electrical brain stimulation for reduced the epileptic seizures under the National Institute of Health support, and the delivery of the antineoplastic and anti-epileptic agents straight into the brain. This also new field, which partly is realized in our universities and centers also. The brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease and epilepsy, what I showed, and as a restorative neurosurgery, epidural spinal cord stimulation, which was realized in Poland since the 80s, so during the beginning of this method, mainly thanks to the cooperation with the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, because Professor Dmitrievich, leading this subject, was cooperating with us, and we did some papers about this. Also in Europe, cooperation with Cambridge University, using our Polish engineering ideas, which were born in Polish University of Technology in Warsaw, for example. This old computer shows the old software, which was one of the first in the world, and was used in a few centers in Poland, but in many centers in the United Kingdom, for example, is still using in new versions. So, of course, we should open our brains for new ideas, and we can follow a study, for example, stem cells for neurology and neurosurgery. There are many questions still promising, but not solved. First, is possible the neuronal differentiation of stem cells? Is the possible treatment of injured spinal cord or brain? Another spine degeneration or brain degeneration could be treated the peripheral nerves injury, or also it could be used for the treatment of brain tumors, and even disc therapy. There is very well recognized disabled Warsaw Research Group, just from the this institute I showed, the Institute of Polish Academy of Sciences, with the group concentrated on neuro repair. It's so called, this division of this institute, and there was recognized the possibility of the evolution of the stem cells to the neuron-like cells, and what I'd like to stress, these papers of this Polish group were cited by military experts in research looking for new ways of treatment of soldiers wounded in the Iraq and Afghanistan. Maybe that injured spinal cord of young people, our soldiers who are serving for our nations, could be better treat it not only using the hardware, but also what can be improved inside of the spine. Another direction, stroke, Parkinson's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, rare disease, but very, very difficult to treat. Also, the researches were done in the Polish Academy of Science. The another question, maybe this neurosurgery of brain tumors would be not very necessary. Is the future, maybe it's the end of our specialty. But of course the main reasons are to improve the changes of the brain cells, malignant cells. So there are papers about this, and such new directions are also about the intervertebral disc changing using the spinal using the stem cells can improve this very common disease, maybe not only using the open surgery, but also using the recovery of the space. Of course, there are new directions like looking for the treatment of cardiovascular diseases. We have some beginning of cooperation with the Miami, University of Miami, with the leading head of that institute and skin defects. Thanks to Maria Michaida, who was working in the Georgetown University on the right side, and the president of Polish American Health Association is the picture from our embassy. Many advices were given to us to realize. And of course there are many centers I showed. There's a center, there was a center of Polish Academy of Sciences, there's another one, Mariusz Latajczak working with the University of Louisville, and in other centers in Szczecin, Krakow, with young people, you can see a very promising group. And Institute of Cardiology, working on the stem cells for cardiological devices. And new center, what we try to establish now. Now it's the building of new laboratory in this old military hospital. Now it's university hospital, and there's a possibility to realize the research on that subject. Also in oncology, looking for the new drugs against the cancer, use new technologies in pharmacotherapy, and we are also looking for the possibilities of using the radiotherapy, the cyberknife, which isn't used still in Poland, in new places in our university. New university, it's also a new possibility, young people, invited by Nicolaus Copernicus and at his flat, and also we have some support from European Parliament. You can see that during the inauguration of the President Jerzy Buzek presidency of a Parliament, the big part of the Polish delegation representatives were from medical world. You can see the Professor Zembala from the Department of Cardiosurgery, me and Professor Opala from Neurology. Poland is growing up, so it's very promising. You can see how fast it's growing. It's, the number of the new students is a dramatic enlargement during less than 20 years. You can also observe that there is only country in Europe where which is still developing, and there is growing up of our production. And there are connections with the neighbors, the Baltic Sea, everywhere, with some ideas. For example, from the idea to application to the installation in also in the some companies realizing ideas. We established also our International Baltic Biomedical Research Center in Olsztyn with the cooperation with the university in Finland, in Turku, Greifswald in Germany. And we are lucky to invite also the MD Anderson Cancer Center to cooperate with us in the in the pharmacological research. The building bridges, the main subject of our meeting here, it's a good moment to remember the person, very famous here. He built a lot of bridges in the United States, Ralph Modieski, the son of famous actress. And, of course, there are not only symbols, there's really needs of cooperation. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, or rather good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. It's good to see so many faces of people whom I met in Gdansk about 2 months ago. This will be the closing talk of the morning session. I want to share a few pieces of information of the program, which was already introduced by Dr. Barker from NCI. We call this program NCI Alliance for Nanotechnology in Cancer, and it is dedicated to using nanotechnology tools in diagnosis, prevention, and therapy of this disease. As we heard from Dr. Barker and other speakers, cancer is a serious problem around the world, in Poland and in the US as well. And there are tools which are working in diagnosing it and also treating it, but these tools, unfortunately, are not working that well. And we hope that some of the nanotechnology concepts can provide disruptive solutions which can really address the problems which couldn't be addressed so far. Nanotechnology in general, I'm sure you read a lot about that in popular and scientific press, is a science of very small objects, of the objects which are 10 to 100 nanometers. 1 nanometer is 1 billion part of the meter. And these small objects behave differently when they are so small as compared to the bulk material which occurs in larger scale. And NCI or NIH recognized the value of nanotechnology in medical applications quite early, and that's the part of the nanotechnology national initiative, which was mentioned earlier. And NIH as a whole is spending about $200 million right now for grants and contracts dedicated to the use of nanotechnology in medical research. NCI budget is probably about more than one-third of that amount. What I think differs this program from any other research activities is that we really are trying to bank on collaboration and interaction of people who are representing very many and very disparate fields. They're not only oncologists and biologists, but there's also a lot of engineers, physicists, and material sciences being involved in that activity. And in a way, we're pushing them to work within large centers. And as that was also mentioned earlier, if you give fairly large amount of money to people of different disciplines and ask them to produce a common result, that despite of the fact that they, in many cases, speak different languages, will produce a common language and help them to produce that final outcome sooner. So to that effect, we funded 8 large centers of cancer nanotechnology center excellence in 2005. So they are almost they're in fourth year of their operation, but we'll be reissuing this program for another 5 years. And as you see, they represent major university and academic centers across the United States. What I think they are contributing to, in addition to producing tremendous amount of data, both in basic but also and applied oncology or technologies for oncology, they are supporting a new model of developing technologies and the models to move these technologies to the commercial environment. If you look at the right upper corner of this graph, the government funding, which funds these activities at the universities, produces the knowledge and intellectual property, which then is being moved to a commercial environment. And this commercial environment also changed in last 20 years. A lot of research in the past was done within the industrial entities, within large pharmaceutical companies in this case. If you look at the landscape of how some of these cancer nanotechnology concepts are being moved to the commercial world, most of the development is occurring in the academic environment. Then many small companies are being spun off from the universities and then produce the technology themselves and commercialize them, or they're being acquired by larger companies. As a result, producing intellectual property at the universities is becoming more important in addition to producing high-quality publication. And again, that model, which has been very successful within our program, is shown in this graph. And to that effect, if you look at the number of companies which were formed from the program, and they are shown here, some of them are large, and of course they existed a long time before the program started, but many, and as Dr. Barker said, about 35 have been formed in the last 4 years. And the rectangles, which are bright green, these are the companies which were started only in last year, and there is 10 of them. So again, that is a reflection of tremendous entrepreneurial attitude of the academics in this program, but in general in this country. So in addition to number of companies, you see also very high quality scientific output of over 1,000 publications. But again, to support this commercial notion, over 200 patents were disclosed or filed. And we have about 8 clinical trials right now which are associated with the technologies produced in the program. Some of them are in, and they, in a way, contribute to all possible applications of nanotechnology diagnosis therapy, and diagnosis both through in vitro assays as well as imaging, and therapy through localized drug delivery. Some of the information about this program reached Poland. There was an article on nanotechnology for cancer published in Politica about 6 months ago, I think, and there was some information about the alliance there. So it seems that these models are reaching European scene and Poland as well. From the technical standpoint, most of the applications which which we're looking at are utilizing nanoparticles which come from very diverse materials. They are both organic or inorganic, and then they are functionalized biologically so they can be delivered locally to the tumor site, and they also can carry the cargo of the therapeutic treatment, and I will show you a few slides on that later on. But again, as I mentioned, there are probably three major facets where nanotechnology can impact cancer in diagnosis, developing new screening methodologies in vitro environment. If you look at this table, which is about 1 year old, only 4 cancers, and unfortunately not the ones which have the worst prognosis, have widely established screening methodology. It's a pap smear and HPV testing for cervical cancer, taking mammograms for breast cancer, PSA testing for prostate cancer, and colonoscopy for colorectal cancer. Unfortunately, cancers which have very poor prognosis, lung, ovarian, pancreatic, have some biomarkers now which are being tested, but do not have well-established and widely applied screening methodology. And it is well known that if we will recognize the disease at the very early stage, hopefully before a metastatic phase, in many cases surgery can basically cure the patient. If it gets to the later stage and metastasis occurs, in many cases it is basically a prolonging of the patient's life. So combination of biomarker discovery and developing new sensors and assays which will have high sensitivity and high specificity and rely on nanotechnology tools can have a very large potential here. They also can be highly multiplex, so they can look at a number of different signatures at the same time. And as we know, most of the tumors will have more than one biomarker associated with them. Similarly, for imaging, development of new contrast agents, which will rely on nanoparticles, can enhance the spatial and temporal resolution. Will also allow to deliver the contrast agents to the organs which are hard to reach, brain, for instance. There is also a possibility, and that's very important for the successful surgeries, to develop a real-time monitoring of the margins of the tumor using quantum dots or other nanoparticles which allow to optically image the area. So surgeon can monitor the margins of the tumor during the surgery, and the need for second surgery, which is very often for, very common for breast cancer patients, for instance, will cease. And last but not the least, nanoparticles also will allow to deliver therapies locally. That will contribute to improved efficacy of the treatment. Because of the localization of the delivery, you will potentially be able to reduce the dose, and by that means also reduce the side effects, which are very severe for current chemotherapies. So this is really not something which will happen in the future. This is happening already, and as I said, we have about 8 clinical trials associated with the technologies which are being developed in this program. Many of them are being developed at the universities. Because of that, materials are being characterized by many different groups, many different parties using different protocols in order to make this characterization more uniform and standardized. We started an entity called Nanotechnology Characterization Lab at NCI about 5 years ago, and this is a group of about 20 people in Frederick, Maryland, and they currently completed development of the assay cascade, which allows very uniformly and very carefully to characterize nanomaterials of different flavors, both from the physical property standpoint and also biochemical property standpoint. And that lab collaborates or works in collaboration with FDA and NIST, and in a way paves the way through the preparation of this data to subsequent IND submissions to FDA for the approval of the technologies. Again, to show that some of that is already occurring in the clinical environment, there is few of the nanoparticle-based therapeutic agents which have been approved by FDA. Doxil, which is all their liposomal formulation, has been approved in mid-90s. Abraxin, which is albumin-bound paclitaxel formulation used for metastatic breast cancer, was approved in 2005. There's few others in both liposomal and polymeric formulations for more specific niche applications, and there is a number of agents, and some and many of them are funded through our program, which are now in fairly advanced preclinical stage and will be filing IND with FDA within a year or so. So again, I think, you know, in a very short period of time, I hope that I was able to show you that this program, first, is producing tremendous amount of data when it comes to using novel technologies, in this particular case, nanotechnology, in cancer research and cancer clinical applications, but also is, in a way, establishing new model which allows to translate the technologies from the university environment to commercial environment, partially using government money, but in many cases also using money which was leveraged by university professors using our funding and raised from other sources like foundations or industry. And in recognition of the success of this program, we were approved for another 5 years of continuation, and that phase will start in 2010. And again, we'll have very multifaceted form of different activities involved in the program, from these large centers of cancer nanotechnology excellence to smaller platform awards, as well as to fairly solid and advanced training programs. We obviously recognize that nanotechnology is very multidisciplinary, and training students who come from engineering and teaching them some basic biology or vice versa will be of significant value here. And we'll be announcing these new awards in about 9 months from today. So again, that's a short introduction to the program before lunch. Thank you for your attention.
I think we have a couple of options here, and I'll defer to folks who know better than I. But we can either take a couple of questions now, or we can that's okay. Wonderful. So if anyone has questions, I think you're using the microphones. Is that yep? Do you want to go ahead? And I think if you can go ahead and speak into the microphone, that would be lovely. Yeah, there's one right behind you.
First of all, I just wanted to thank the speakers in this session for having chosen a way to present the lectures in a way which even people like myself could follow and at least partly understand. Now, with my non-medical background, I can only ask very general questions, but I just have two. The first one is really very general, and it refers to the philosophy of public health these days, which I know is a pressing problem everywhere in the US and Poland and otherwise. And I certainly take reference to the fact that with the ever-increasing costs of research, which is followed by increasing cost of diagnosis and therapy, my question is whether we really face a problem, against the our wish to provide an affordable healthcare to everyone. Are you actually thinking that we can have a smaller problem in the future, or the problem will increase until something happens which we don't know what? I think this is a major problem, which is a concern of everyone. And there is no simple answer, obviously, I know. But if we could have some comments on your part regarding this basic problem of how we should think in terms of the future of public health, I would very much appreciate it. Now, my second comment is probably kind of different and simpler. I know there is a lot of people collaborating in Poland and the U.S. And fortunately, we have established links, and we also have ways to support research. And so that, from that perspective, everything is okay. However, I very much believe that we should collaborate more than that. The question is, what do you think are the obstacles on the way that we collaborate in a still insufficient range of different research areas? And the question which goes together is, we are a loyal and reliable member of the European Union now, and we obviously have a lot of opportunities to collaborate within the Union. So the question is, would that be better to think in terms of being your partner within the consortia built within the European Union, or perhaps there are some reasons to think that bilateral collaboration is also advisable and perhaps in this or another sense more promising?
So both wonderful questions. The first one relating to tackling the health cost problem, and then the second one about the various ways that the U.S. and Poland might do a better job of collaborating or building on existing collaborations. Dr. Drajewski, do you want to tackle the first question? I think your discussion spoke to it a little bit, and I know you have thoughts about it.
Work together, and this is a question more addressed to politicians than to experts, medical experts. I believe that demographical changes we are facing very fast, and the increasing cost of new types of sophisticated treatments clearly lead our systems to collapse, either in the United States or in Poland. So this is the way the politicians want to choose to come to the very risky point and to make society aware of the change that we need, or just to make step by step on evolutionary way. So we need for sure a close cooperation of new scientific specialists, IT economists, and social psychologists, sociologists, just to push the changes we need into real world. So this is my short answer. We need to really change our thinking about public health in terms of Tallinn Charter. I showed on the second slide presents. We need to think about performance and the outcome, also economical outcome of the system. If we don't do this, then the system will collapse.
And I would just add that this is a conversation that is a major part of the larger health reform conversation that's going on in the United States right now. There is a wide recognition that the United States spends a lot of money, and in all cases not as efficiently as possible. So the discussions about reforming Medicare, some of the discussions about comparative effectiveness, are aimed at doing a better, more efficient job of delivering health care. And I think there's a growing recognition in this country that that we can do that. So it's a conversation that's going on across the European Union, obviously, in Poland, but it is one of the keys to doing a good job of delivering health care globally.
So on the last question, I think that we collaborate a lot with the EU. We do a lot of things with the EU, but we also do a lot of things outside the EU based on specific issues and specific problems. And I think, you know, based on the opportunities, we should think about both. And I would encourage you to think about both, because especially in the chronic disease area, especially around cancer, there are some specific issues in Poland that we'll need to work on together that aren't necessarily the same issues that the EU would address and is addressing. Your first question, I'm of different mind on this than some, I guess, because I think we are at an absolutely crucial point in the history of mankind, not just of where we are and what we're going to become, I think, is going to depend on what we do now. And we have spent all these years actually discovering, and I think in many ways driven by what the NIH and this country has invested in cancer research and biomedical research in general, which has been, I think, which has allowed a lot of global explosion of cancer research and biomedical research. But we have discovered so much, and I think the question is now, are we going to exploit it or are we not for future generations? And I think how we answer that question will in fact determine what this human race is going to look like in 50 to 100 years. And I mean, I can cite you many examples where we have invested, for example, in genomics, and take chronic myelogenous leukemia as an example. Up until a very few years ago, everybody died from that disease unless they got a bone marrow transplant. With the discovery of the fusion gene, actually, which took a long time and a lot of effort, and it might be argued that it, you know, maybe it wasn't the most cost-effective thing in the world, but now every patient is cured of this disease, or most patients are cured of this disease with no bone marrow transplant, and a bone marrow transplant can run, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars up to $1 million if, in fact, your morbidity is high. So every time that we have delivered with advanced technologies to improve therapy and very specifically based on an understanding of the disease that allows us to be very specific in our treatments, we win, the patients win, the economy wins. So I think we're at a transition, and I think it's probably as important as the Industrial Revolution in terms of what we do with all this information, and are we going to have the resources, and are we going to have the patients to exploit what we know how to do now? I think it's a huge question.
Okay. Dr. Wessner, did you have I think we're running out of time.
Yes, that was my principal observation is that your lunch awaits. It does not improve by waiting. And just two last, if I may, substantive comments, Don. One is I think this illustrates why we're having this meeting. I think Dr. Barker made it very clear that there is scientific opportunity there is a collaborative opportunity. I would like to address the EU versus the bilateral. The only reasons you would want to cooperate bilaterally with us is that we have the money, we have the resources, and we have the will, and we have the speed, and we have the agility. Aside from that, those of you who did not note Dr. Barker's observation that we are mortal may wish to go into the EU collaborative phase.
But politically well said, Chuck.
And may I, with that, thank you, Don, and thank this outstanding panel.
Yes.
Could we have a round of applause?
Yes, an excellent panel.